You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
This is Sam Rocha, and you are listening to a Breadbox Media presentation of my lectures on the Catholic intellectual tradition, given at St. Mark's College in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Hopefully the depth of the distinctions and the big ideas is set in, mostly. I'm going to keep crawling along, because when we come out of Thucydides, Thucydides gives us some wonderful descriptions, not only of battles and war, but really of Greek society, and in particular the distinction we find between Athenian society and Spartan society. To sort of wrap things up, though, and be able to move forward, the basic distinction between Sparta and Athens is political, in a very, I think, in a thematic way. So Athens is, of course, the, you could say, earliest record within the Western memory, place where something approaching democracy was attempted. Before you get too excited about it, when you look at the details of the Athenian democracy, it would probably be seen as a fairly authoritarian regime, because they were very exclusive about who got to vote, and it would be a landowning, male-owning, all these things. But it was a place in which authority and power was dispersed, and governance and legislation was done in a way that relied on rhetoric. So there was a political rhetoric that was used, that was also used in the courts and the judicial system, and that was used to really sway. So the persuasion of rhetoric in that context. Sparta was very much a militaristic nation state that had a not so much a purely. It was an interesting nation state, actually, because it wasn't purely reducible to some kind of aristocratic rule. It wasn't strictly authoritarian in the way we think of most militarized societies. It certainly had plenty of that. But the idea of civic identity for Sparta was that every Spartan, which included men and women, before its time, probably not what you might have expected, to be a citizen was synonymous with being a Spartan soldier. So there was no sense in which anyone who was a citizen was also not a soldier. So there was this deeply nationalistic, in a way, sense of identity that the Spartans had, that meant that, among other things, that there was a very authoritarian regime for, like, military training, because how is it sensible to call yourself a soldier when you're not trained, right, in martial arts or in the arts of war, right? So Sparta is where we actually find the first compulsory institution for the purposes of civic initiation. What you could call today a public school system, right, where people are by law required to attend an institution in order to be initiated into the polis. Now, today, the compulsory schooling model is just as robust politically, in terms of we have truancy laws, and, you know, parents can lose guardianship, and there's a lot of very strict ways in which schooling is enforced. But it's not mainly for militaristic training entirely. It's become, in some sense, liberalized a bit. Athens, there was really no such things, but in Athens we see a different kind of institution, largely because it didn't have the strictness of the Spartan regime. And in Athens we see the foundation of the Academy. And the Academy is literally the name of the institution that Plato, a student of Socrates, founded in Athens. And then Plato's student, Aristotle, founded another institution called the Lyceum. And these were both schools, but they were not compulsory schools. They were schools that you didn't have to go to, but you could if you were interested in whatever it was that Plato or Aristotle were talking about that day. Now, the difference between the Academy and the Lyceum as institutions and the Spartan compulsory school is significant, I think, for a number of reasons. One, you find a very strong confusion today when we talk about schools, and that we tend to talk about education as reducible to schooling institutions. Here I would reject that for the reasons I've said before. But we also find that school is often reducible to a weird kind of have your cake and eat it too account, where, oh yeah. Yeah, welcome. No, this is Sarah. Sarah's going to join us. Let's get started. Oh, is that okay?
Yeah.
So hopefully you can see this conflation that happens when we talk about education. So I've rejected that education that doesn't go all the way up here by Rocha's own personal standards isn't serious. Okay, fine. But even when we talk about school, we find that there's a very much kind of have your cake and eat it too idea thing, where we're mainly usually talking about school within a political compulsory context when we're talking about like K-12, right? So there are laws literally that govern and enforce the attendance of these institutions, that make them free, then this, that, and the other, blah, blah, blah. Even within the private, public, independent, home, school, it all is still governed by a set of laws that exist very strictly to pertain to it. Yet, they want to talk about the subject matter or the content as this very, like, everything from liberal arts to being more academic in nature, this, that, and the other. Let me just be really clear in terms of this distinction here, because it's going to also be made more sense of as we look at Catholic institutions. The purposes of the compulsory rule in Sparta were civic in both the best, but also you could say the worst senses, in that they were meant to socialize people into Spartan society in such a way that they could be homogenized within the larger polis of Sparta. And their purpose was not so much the method of fighting as the identity of being a Spartan, fighting like a Spartan, eating like a Spartan, all these sorts of things, right? In Athens, the Academy and the Lyceum, and Socrates' school that never existed, the sort of public school of Socrates, which was literally him walking around the public and asking people really weird questions, right? This style of school is not civic at all. In fact, its relationship to the state, Socrates got killed for the corruption of Athenian youth. Plato's works are read as possibly using Socrates as a political stand-in so that he could stay out of the way. Aristotle was a mercenary and went and tutored Alexander the Great and much talked about Persia in the last lecture. So the relationship between the institution of the school and the state, between Sparta and Athens, couldn't be more different. In the case of Sparta, there was a strong tie between the state and the school, and in fact the school was civic in the fact that it prepared people or initiated people for full participation into that state. Whereas the schools of Athens were not only agnostic about the relationship to the state, but in many cases the state saw them as antagonistic to their principles, right?
Subversive,
totally subversive, right? And this begins a similar line of themes as we can sort of see. I would claim that the Athenian approach gives us a set of big questions that just wander and loom and confuse and get paired up. Yes?
You mentioned this, but who funded each school?
Oh, right. So, good question. So in the case of Sparta, being that its relationship to the state was so strict, it was funded by, the state ones, right? So it belonged to the polis. I don't know about the specifics of, like, taxation and what that would have looked like. But I do know that it was, you know, provided for all. Very, by the way, very egalitarian. Remember I mentioned that, like, women would have been seen as part of this. I don't think the training would have been the same for men and women, but it was pretty flat, you know, across. Whereas here, I don't think, especially Socrates' school was just not funded. He just walked around and talked to people. Plato's school, I don't know exactly about the model. Like, I don't know if he, like, leased the building or not, or someone loaned it to him or whatever. Aristotle's interesting because Aristotle got paid a bit to be a teacher, right, by, like, people like Alexander and stuff like that. So in that case, it was more like a consumer good, you could say, where, like, the teacher was actually being paid. As we're going to see in a little bit, the model of teaching and pay changes whenever Rome enters the scene, but we'll get to there in a bit. The key here, though, is that the Athenian schools were basically just sort of grew out of curiosities, even scandals like Socrates in the face of the polis of Athens. Whereas Sparta was really built on a method, a civic method, a method for creating a strong city-state, and no one can deny that the Spartans were, you might say, the paragon of strength when it came to Athens. What I want to be clear, though, is if you choose to take this method in order to achieve this sort of result, hopefully you can already see that there's going to be some irony, if not absurdity, in the attempts to build it. And I want to be clear as we look at Catholic institutions to show that the Catholic intellectual tradition really doesn't emphasize to almost any degree, and the Eastern Rite even less so, a sense of inheritance or relationship to the Spartan model of schooling. It's very much heavily invested. Paul goes to an Athens, right? It's very much invested on an Athenian Hellenic line, which runs all through here, but I think this contrast is an important one. Why? Because even when we look at religion, which is why I wanted to kind of like maybe use the word in a slightly different way, the purpose of religion, especially in the area of Greece and Rome and the Middle East and what have you, was really had something of a relationship to the Spartan compulsory schooling model, and that it was, you could say, the content that provided a strong sense of whether it was ethnic or tribal, or it brought a people together, right? And it had the law, you know, and things like that. And so to be a member of a religion was really a sign of particularity, and the way that Spartan society was very much about the particular. Catholicism, Catholicos, Christianity was really a scandal to this idea of religion because it called itself universal. And it was supposedly a cut across gender lines and Gentile and Jew lines, and it was cosmopolitan, and you didn't have to obey all the laws of the Jew, you know, for instance. It was really a radical idea of which the I think we can find some ways in which the application then of what we might call religious education within a Catholic Athenian Hellenic line would necessarily have to look very different than it might look like through a different line. Even Judaism in this case, especially Orthodoxy even today, would look very, very different. Why? Because the purposes, I would say, are a bit different on this level. Why? Because some of the civic, or lack thereof, of civic engagement just cut around different lines. So this distinction between Sparta and Athens is more than just a really sloppy rendition of ancient history. What it's really meant to do is to show two models of society, two models of the state that come up with very different ideas about what the school would look like, and obviously different ideas of what education would be. Right.
We'll be back with more Catholic intellectual tradition on Breadbox Media.
You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
Hi, this is Allison Gingras, host of The Seeking Heart with Allison Gingras, your on-air book club. A Seeking Heart features daily live discussions, weekly giveaways, and author interviews. We don't just review books, we share them, and you're invited to participate by calling in or posting your comments on social media. The best part, no reading necessary. I got you covered. Please visit a Seeking Heart show page on breadboxmedia.com for showtimes and featured books.
This is Sam Rocha, and you are listening to a Breadbox Media presentation of my lectures on the Catholic intellectual tradition, given at St. Mark's College in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Let's talk a bit about the people in Athens. As you can see, that's where my weight's going to lean into. Anyone read any Socrates? It's a trick question.
No,
he never wrote anything, right? Socrates would have never gotten tenure at UBC. He was a horrible academic. In fact, he wasn't an academic. He was a philosopher, right? This is a bit of a critique of modern day academic philosophy. But if we've read Socrates, we've read Socrates the character who appears all over Plato's writings. What were Plato's writings? What do they look like? Has anyone read
dialogues?
Yeah? Dialogues, right? What is a dialogue? Like, what does it remind you of when you read it?
It's like the one who proposes a question. He sort of, the person usually not quite as intelligent, they respond, and the question proposer kind of like provokes. Humiliates the question responder. Yeah. Eventually, the question asker appears more brilliant and becomes some kind of resolution.
Or not. The resolution is not really. Or like they like, screw you, man. I'm going to the funeral I'm late for already. Yeah. There's a sense in which they read sort of low, like a play, don't they?
Yeah. Dramatic. Yeah.
Well, I mean, they literally have like so and so says, so and so says, and so and so says. The point though is that. And I'm not a classicist, so I don't know. There's a huge controversy of, like, are these direct accounts of stuff that Socrates was actually saying and Plato was just taking notes, or he got notes from someone else who took notes? Or are these tales of stuff Socrates was said to say? Or are they all just made up for a number of equally different reasons why? I have no idea. All I do know is that the form of Platonic writing, the earliest in this tradition of philosophical texts, not counting the pre-Socratics, who I'm very crassly leaving out here, is more literary than it is academic. Like, it reads like so-and-so said such-and-such, and so-and-so replied such-and-such. And so, and there's humor in them, even. If you read closely, it can be actually kind of funny. The point that I'm making, though, is that, speaking of, like, the tradition here, right, Plato shows us that the school of Socrates that Plato represents, and that becomes Platonism, really favors a much more literary presentation and representation of the work of doing philosophy. What is that word? Well, philosophy means love of wisdom. So wisdom, we think about the wisdom traditions, the early stuff there. There's not a whole lot in Plato with respect to method. Plato, I don't think you could call him a methodical thinker, although there is a method to the way he writes and the way that he represents ways of reasoning. A lot of the questions in Plato have references to classical Homeric themes. One of them is like, what is a good life? But one of the themes that I like a lot, that I think we can recognize in another book that probably many of us are familiar with, is the theme of the expert who is a fool. Right? So Socrates in the Meno, Meno seeks out Socrates because he's supposedly really smart, and Meno is an ethicist. He has like a column in like, you know, the weekly periodical, and he gives talks on ethics. And he asks Socrates, tell me, Socrates, can virtue be taught? Okay. So as an ethicist, he knows virtue, and he wants to know, like, how to teach it. So it's, some people see it as, like, the first philosophy of education question, right, you know. And Socrates says, gosh, I have no idea, because I have no clue what virtue is. Do you happen to know what virtue is? And Meno's like, are you kidding me? What do you mean? I mean, I thought you were smart. You don't know what virtue is. And Socrates is like, no, I'm an idiot. Tell me, what is virtue? And he's like, wow, virtue is, and he just goes off, right? It's beauty, justice, and fairness, and proportion. And then Socrates says, wow, Meno, I was under the impression that virtue was one thing, but you've told me many things. Am I supposed to suspect that the swarm of the things you told me is a single bee? Or is the thing you told me the sum of the parts of the swarm you told me that comprise a single bee? And it confuses me. It was like, okay, well, let me try it again. And before you know, Meno is yelling at Socrates, calling him a torpedo fish.
Stingray. Or
stingray, yeah, saying you just go around confusing people and numbing them. And then Socrates is like, oh, well, if I numb them, is it because I myself am numb? Or is it, you know, they go off on this other thing. Then they're doing geometry, trying to double a square. And it looks kind of crazy, right? One point of this dialogue, which occurs in almost every other dialogue, is Socrates humiliates the expert by showing them that the things, not just the things they claim to know casually, but the things they claim expertise to, are a fact built on assumptions and not on truth, and certainly not on wisdom. Right?
So he confuses the people who think they're wise.
Yeah, yeah.
The people who don't say they know nothing are the wise guys.
Yeah, it becomes this Socratic sort of sign of virtue, which some people call false humility, some call it just like how to be really annoying, you know, like others like that. Another dialogue, you see from Socrates, here's Plato's really heavy-handed, right? Socrates meets a guy on the way to prosecute his father for impiety. And Socrates says, oh, that's interesting. Normally, do sons normally prosecute their fathers for impiety? He's like, well, you know, we must defend piety at all. Well, what is piety? You know where this is going, right? Before we know it, it's about like, whoa, and how is it that but impious fathers can have pious sons, and, you know, like big questions. The point, though, that one of the ideas that comes out of the Athenian Academy and the Lyceum that really also runs counter to this spirit we find up here, but also shows you some making sense of these themes, is the idea that claims to truth or to fact or to method are insufficient for making appeals to wisdom. So just because you know all the facts, just because you're great at Jeopardy, just because you know all the dates and names and figures, just because you're really good at playing chess, it might mean you're smart, but you may still not be wise. And so the question of the good life in relationship to love of wisdom and the education in directions of what it means to be an educated person, as you can see, it's all bubbles out of this Platonic idea. Now, there might not be method to Plato, but there's definitely metaphysics in Plato. And so I want to give you a sense of what Plato's sort of metaphysical system was, because in many ways, I hope it's not too crazy to say that the metaphysical system that Plato built, while it probably had its points that could be over and under emphasized, as we'll see with the next guy, I don't think we'll ever get out of a kind of Platonic metaphysical model entirely.
Can you sort of just simplify what metaphysics is?
Yeah, so metaphysics is basically the question of, like, why is there something instead of nothing? Or what is the nature of the somethingness of things that doesn't let it fall completely into nothingness? So, like, in Genesis, whenever we see, we talked about in the, up here, so in Genesis, whenever we look at the Genesis account, it shows this deep sense of, like, nothingness that preceded creation. Right.
So, reality.
Yeah. What is the nature of reality? What is the nature? But also at a conceptual level, like not just the nature of reality, like the trees outside.
The abstract form.
Yeah. Exactly. What is real? Yeah. Yeah. Totally. I would say it's a little different than truth, which would be more testing, like how are our claims How can our claims be tested in such a way that we can deduce them as to whether they're right or wrong? This is bigger. This is what is real, like the real. And like, how does it behave? How does it function? Out of that, we get, of course, epistemology, which is a question about truth and stuff. But when I say metaphysics, what I mean, more strictly speaking, is Plato's sort of Plato's model, in which Plato believed that reality that we perceive through our senses. So, what shape is this book unfolding? What shape is it?
Rectangle,
right? Plato would say, in this sort of, you might say, kind of first glance reality, ordinary experience reality, these things are never what we say they are. If you measure this really strictly speaking, any decent geometrician will be able to tell you that this is not a rectangle, perfectly speaking, in any sense. In fact, no one has experienced geometry at a perfect ideal level. We can just make deductions about some of the sort of metrics of geometry, but we don't actually experience the world through perfection of shapes. And so for Plato, the way in which we recognize shape or color or any sense impression is really through a perception that takes us from the world we live in into this other world, which is the world of the perfections or the forms. This world of the forms, or some people call it the world of ideas. But in this world of the ideas, which is external to the material world, here we find the essences and their essential, perfect, divine, you could say, structure. And divine, I use as a... Plato has this deeply divinizing language in the same way that Homer does when he talks about the questions of life and death and immortality and all this kind of stuff. So for Plato, what allows us to see things and perceive things and understand reality is not the experience of natural reality as we see it and as experience it, but it's the ability of not just our brain, but our intellect, our mind, nous, another word for soul. Yeah, yeah.
What about language?
So for him...
Because your language, I don't know, isn't there such a big connection?
Between language...
Your word... As an idea.
Sure.
And that we, like, there may be, like, other cultures have words that don't exist in English that represent different forms.
Oh, sure.
So that my language defines, in some sense, what I see.
Sure.
Because there's things that exist that I don't have the language for.
Sure. I mean, that's a theory of reality, right? That's definitely a metaphysical view. It's a metaphysical view that becomes a little bit more salient with Plato, but for Plato, actually, he wouldn't so much talk about the world that we language or the world that we speak about. He would say just the nature of reality as we experience it within any part of the senses, right? So the ability for me to recognize without looking or seeing that this is my book and that this is, I feel it, my Apple computer, right? That even the ability for our senses without sight, right? Or if we blinded the senses in some other kind of way, the ability for us to perceive reality and especially to rationally perceive reality, so it's through reason and intellect. Even if we do that with or without, you know, language. Now, of course, this is built on a sort of, you might say, very like full realist understanding. So for him, things come before ideas or words or stuff like that. There's stuff, right? Even if it's unnameable, you could see something, perhaps, in the natural world, you know, that way. So if I see a bird that we haven't assigned a name to, we could still be like, look at that thing over there, you know, and you're like, oh, okay, what's it called? I have no idea. It's beautiful, or, you know, or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. For Plato, he would say, though, that everything that's going on there isn't built on a material foundation, but that our mind, which for the Greeks referred to nous, which is a word that gets us really close, not so much to brain or cognition, but really to soul. That our soul is able to recollect the perfect form and you could say repatriated back into our intellect, and then we say, oh wow, that's a rectangle. But I don't know that's a rectangle, because this is not a rectangle. For Plato, there's nothing real in a strict sense about this being a rectangle. The only realness of this rectangle is its analogy and its correspondence to the perfection of the rectangular, right? In its essential form. Now, when you get into the details of Plato's metaphysics, in the world of forms itself, there's this demiurge from which all the perfections come out of. And you start to see a prefigurement of a lot of ideas that will come across as like just like very like boldly Christian in some cases, right? But for Plato, what's important about this is that the human mind is A, not purely cognitive, it's also spiritual to the soul. And its spirituality has a purpose. It's not just to feel New Agey. It's the purpose is to escape, you could say, what he would call the cage of the body in the material world, and to, as spirit, ruach, going back to the beginning, as spirit, go off into this other world and then bring that other world into awareness through recollection. And that would be what we would consider knowledge.
We'll be back with more Catholic intellectual tradition on Breadbox Media.
You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
I'm Timothy Putnam, host of Outside the Walls, heard every weekend on Breadbox Media. Join me as we explore the foundations and implications of our faith. We'll approach Scripture and writings from the doctors and fathers of the Church, along with other ecclesial documents. Then we'll have a conversation with a guest about how our faith informs the way we approach the important issues we face every day. And together, we'll prepare to live outside the walls. For showtimes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
This is Sam Rocha, and you are listening to a Breadbox Media presentation of my lectures on the Catholic intellectual tradition, given at St. Mark's College in Vancouver, British Columbia.
As spirit, go off into this other world, and then bring that other world into awareness through recollection, and that would be what we would consider knowledge. Now, once we have something before us in knowledge, we can do this process and test it, so that becomes metaphysics' epistemology is justified true beliefs. So how do we take these things that we believe are true and test them to show that they are justifiably accountable as true? Well, that would just be a more rounds to the recollection tree, you could say, right? But what's most important to me about Plato to make sense of this, to distinguish it from Aristotle, is that it's external, and then the denominator is, it's about correspondence. So this gets to the language question in a probably better way. For Plato, on Plato's account, if we encounter something here that does not correspond in the externalized movement of the soul to something here, then it's simply not a thing. It just doesn't exist. Right, because things are verified not through their material embodied shape or manifestation, but through this externalized process. And so the correspondence between this and this is how we test this. Now, you might say, well, where does he come up with this idea? Well, if we read the pre-Socratics, which it's a shame that I couldn't go in more detail about them, you can see that a lot of pre-Socratic philosophy in Greece was deeply, deeply both naturalistic, but also deeply mathematical. Now, the Greeks didn't have a script for zero. Here's an example. They didn't have language for zero like the Hindus did, like the Mayans did, by the way. Like the Romans also didn't, right? You know, there's no zero Roman numerals. But they had concepts that they could actually think about things that would have been zero without the language for zero. For instance, their geometry system and stuff like this. Very interesting ways of thinking. But you can see how Plato would have been influenced by this very abstract mathematical sensibility, such that he would be moved to think that this can only work through concepts, and concepts, of course, need to escape this in order to get out there. The reason I'm building this model is also to contrast Plato from Aristotle. But by the way, for the sake of like the whole education thing, this recollection thing, philosophy of education has been trying to make up reasons why, oh yeah, we're not doing this anymore. But every time it does it, it almost reoccurringly does it again. Like it seems like the only way to break this is by like doing it again, which of course doesn't quite break it. There's this recollection motif. It also takes us to things like Odyssean nostalgia, trying to return home. Things like eternal recurrence in Nietzsche. Yeah.
So could you show me just an example of how that would apply to education?
Oh, well, it's basically the earliest kind of cogent learning theory that has really ever been kind of like postulated.
So you're saying they would teach using this pedagogy? Or this?
Well, when I'm talking about education, I'm really talking about sort of theories of sort of what education itself is.
Yeah.
So for a lot of people who say like, oh, education, like the hashtag SMC learns. Okay. So people said, oh, what is learning, right? So for a lot of people, like, oh, we needed to come up with a better cognitive model of how the mind works in order to make sense of what learning is. A lot of people, again, will say, like, well, those you know, the Greeks, they had some ideas, but now we have, like, you know, CAT scans and neurology and very advanced, you know, systems and stuff. But they tend to still work on a realist correspondence basis between objects and their reference, and like it tends to still fall along the same lines. So, for instance, a lot of Plato's language for this was like recollection, worked around the idea of memory. So to learn was really more like to remember. It was never to like learn for the first time. And so you can see how learning theories, including like in educational psychology, are constantly working on an axis of really what you would probably more specifically talk about as memory work. Right? You know? So like evidence of student learning usually doesn't have anything to do with them learning. It really has to do with them remembering long enough, right, in order to get there. And this is what happens, though, is my claim, right, is that we've indeed even forgotten about the richest senses of memory because the method of memory work has become so ensconced there. Right?
Yeah. It seems to be saying that the knowledge is already infused.
Yeah. Well, not so much infused, but that it's out there and it's real, and nothing we can do here can do anything other than correspond to it. But there's this really—I mean—the metaphysics here is sort of like obnoxiously strong, right? Because it says that we don't get to decide or think a whole lot of or challenge, you could say, the way things are out here. And so like in mathematics, it's that whenever we come up with a proof, we didn't discover that. No, we didn't make that up. We didn't invent that with language or whatever. We've discovered something that is always eternally and forever eternally will always be true, right? So 1 + 1 = 2, the proof of working that out, isn't on the Platonic view. I'm not always a technist, so don't. If you want to quarrel, don't. On a Platonic view, 1 + 1 = 2, its proof, is not something that someone came up with. It's that someone came up with language, this is maybe a better response, found the language to describe, but this is always universally forever and will always forever be true. So for Plato, there's this external, but also enchanted external relationship to these forms that escape, and so he takes literary approaches, right, to dig them out. Story, rhetoric, hyperbole, humiliation, humor, things like that. Aristotle was his student. And Aristotle, in just about every single respect, agrees with Plato about metaphysics. First of all, he agrees that metaphysics is important. Aristotle even says in the Ethics that metaphysics begins with poesis. So he takes metaphysics all the way back to... A lot of people like to antagonize Plato and Aristotle, so I want to start off by saying they actually agreed on just about everything. However, Aristotle believed that the Platonic metaphysical system, for all of its compellingness and truth, could also be worked in an opposite, with an opposite circuitry. What I mean by that is Aristotle still believed in there being the forms, but he was less certain that this recollection thing was the only recourse we have to truth. He said, isn't it the case that we don't have to take everything and bounce it out, you know, somewhere else? Can't we also open it up and look inside and see if there's anything on the inside, external, internal, if there's anything on an internal analysis that can show us some lasting truth just as permanent and just as absolute as the external truths of the forms? That was Aristotle's thesis. So as you can notice, Aristotle remains within the correspondence Platonic tradition of metaphysics, but he internalizes. He had internalized metaphysics, where he says, we don't have to float away into the ether exclusively to get at this stuff. And maybe what Plato's saying is that even when we're looking into things, we're actually doing this anyway. Okay, fine. But what Aristotle did was, in a much more, you could say, natural scientific way, showed how the soul, de anima, one of his books, can look into things on an internal basis and understand internal properties to things. So for Aristotle, we don't have to escape ourselves in the natural world. We have to, in some sense, excavate into ourselves in the natural world in order to understand them. So, for instance, this will come up more later down the timeline, but like the idea of transubstantiation. It's a thoroughly Aristotelian construct. Right? That language and that idea is thorough. It says, even though it appears as if nothing is happening because our eyes don't usually see any change in what happens, the internal structure of reality of the thing can retain its accidental properties, the ones we see, yet entirely change its substantial properties. So to transcend substance, transubstantiation, to transcend the substantial, one could retain the accidental. And this, of course, whether you... it's church teaching, all those things. But I mean, if you want to test it philosophically, right, you could say, well, can we imagine this happening in a more natural circumstance that doesn't require, like, you know, church teaching and stuff?
There's a question of the real presence of Christ.
Yes. So this is the answer of the real part of that question, right? It's Aristotle, we'll see how Aquinas use Aristotle to build that answer out. But we can think of it in a more natural, basic way. Certainly you don't have to believe in that in order to understand Aristotle. Think about whenever someone says that at a deep fundamental level that I am a different person. Do you need to change clothes? Do you need to get a haircut? Right? Do you need to do anything to your accidental self in order to experience deep, substantial change as a person? I think we all know, right? That, and in fact, it could be the case that in trying to substantially change, you could go and try to change yourself accidentally even. I'm going to go and put on a suit and tie to feel more like a real professor, you know. And then I'll come in and I'll still be insecure and inside nothing will change, right? In that case, the accidental properties don't necessarily interact. So this basic distinction between substance and accident, it's a distinction that functions in an interesting shadow way, in a Platonic way, but it's not externalized to the outside of the forms, it's internalized. So instead of having the soul running out and then coming back, here the soul, in some sense, goes deeper into the soul. Right. So Augustine, for all of his Platonic influences, which we'll talk about, he has this sense of talking about himself. He says in the Confessions, my inner self is a house divided against itself, the divided self, right? There's competing selves inside of myself. That's what happens when you take a more internalized approach, right? You find that even within things that seem to be holes, there are parts. And then within the parts that you look at long enough and appear to be holes, there are parts within the part, right? And then within the part that seem to be holes, there are parts within those parts. And so you have this internalized metaphysical beautiful kind of image, whereas with Plato you have what I find another also deeply compelling but externalized sort of transcending moving metaphysical model. Yeah.
How would Plato justify his theory sort of using examples?
Well, I think like math, so like in the Meno, yeah, she uses geometry very specifically speaking.
But how about like in a human situation, like where is this transfer? Is it purely theoretical, or is there something we can sort of correspond it to know that this thing's happening, you know?
Sure. Well, first of all, let's just...
Evidence, maybe, yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, so let's just show that, like, for instance, as much as, like, neuroscience is chugging along, they still don't have really any idea of what mind or consciousness really is, right? So there's still... Everyone who's working in the psychic realm or the psychological realm, I think, is kind of making it up, right? And I think Plato is doing the same thing. Here's one thing that's an interesting controversy. It won't answer your question, but it might maybe make it a little bit more difficult.
Sure.
Some people wonder, like, what are his motivations, right? So is he making this stuff up purely, or is he making this stuff up in order to advance or to argue against someone? Because a lot of times you read classical texts and you don't realize that everything they're writing is against somebody else. So they might see something differently if they just had to say what they think. So the question of, like, was Plato a proto-secularist, or did Plato believe in the gods? Very basic question. Plato talks about the gods.
The question.
But you could see how, right, if Plato had theological intentions, that this would really work.
Yeah.
And yet you could also see, perhaps, that if Plato was critiquing Hellenic, Greek
interventionist,
that this could be a substitutionary theological account for it as well.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And you can think of a different, like at least five or six reasonable, I think, you know, speculations about why Plato would come up with this. The other side of it, and this is a part where it's, I'm going to be just very unsophisticated. I think he's, theoretically speaking, as right as a theorist can be.
Right.
Yeah. So, in other words, this thought experiment, even though the metaphors may not work for us as an explanatory device, this idea of basic correspondence and of the fact that things in front of us can't just be taken at face value. If we go with Plato, we take them out. If we go with Aristotle, we go in. But that the sort of natural way things are require investigation. On that basis, which also I think supports his thesis, I think him and Aristotle are just like right. No, that's what I think.
One more thing is, what about the element of surprise? Like, you can be doing science and you can discover something you didn't know was there, right?
Yeah.
Are you therefore discovering stuff that you somehow didn't know but weren't aware of?
Here we get into philosophy of science. So the Platonist is going to say, if it's true and if, you know, and if scientifically you verify the scientific community, there's consensus. Modern science today will never say anything other than this is highly, highly, highly probable and repeatable across time. They'll never say the Platonic thing that Plato would say and be like, cut it out. It's been there forever.
True,
you know. But here's the thing. When you get into method, you can't get to the hardest probabilities without the mathematicians on the other side helping you out. And their understanding of number and philosophy of number and philosophy of mathematics that buttresses it
is
deeply Platonic. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, it's a really tough thing to both get out of, yet, as you can imagine, you know, when you're talking about, like, you know, how to teach kids, you know, the alphabet, it's not on first glance like the most applicable idea. Like, you would easily dismiss it as just like, whatever, you know, whatever.
back with more Catholic intellectual tradition on Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Coming up this week on Manage Your Money God's Way, we're going to test your financial literacy. My what? How well you understand finances. You know, how do you handle money? Plus, do you remember your first job, and what advice are you telling your kids? We have a few things to share ourselves when it comes to that first job, no matter if you're cutting grass, babysitting, or starting your own business. That's Manage Your Money God's Way from Compass Catholic Ministries, Saturday mornings at 9 Eastern and Sunday afternoons at 5 Eastern on Breadbox Media.
This is Sam Rocha, and you are listening to a Breadbox Media presentation of my lectures on the Catholic intellectual tradition, given at St. Mark's College in Vancouver, British Columbia.
But yeah,
a question that how could we actually get out of the cave in order to know the truth?
Well, you're introducing another Platonic metaphor, so you're going to make me do more work here. Good. But it's good work. Okay, so let's set aside metaphysics for just a second, because this will get us back into metaphysics. But let me just tell people what the cave is, okay? Mm-hmm. How many people know what Plato's cave?
No.
Not Plato's cave downstairs. Yeah. I don't understand why that's called Plato's cave, because if you know the allegory of the cave, it's sort of weird. Anyway, so in the Republic, which the Republic is Plato's attempt to describe a civic order, the ideal kind of utopos, the utopia, that sort of like a governable society. And when you look closely at Plato's idea of politics, it's the politics that correspond most closely to something like this metaphysical arrangement. So there's something about Plato's metaphysics that informs his epistemology, his theory of mind, Aristotle's early philosophy of science, but even the idea of politics. Aristotle also wrote a politics, also wrote an ethics, you know, on and on and on. In Plato's Republic, he gives us another story that even the people who tried to subvert it, I think, just end up falling further into it. And it's called The Allegory of the Cave. And the allegory runs along these lines, that you have prisoners who are in a cave, and they're looking at a wall, and upon that wall, in that cave, there's a big fire behind them, and above that, and between that fire and that wall, there is like, you know, shapes coming in front, and those shapes are projected on the wall in front of them, but all they've ever seen is the projections on that wall. This actually gets at the language question too in a weird way. And so all they know to be true are the things in front of them. You can see how this is also kind of a critique of the forms in a weird way, right? These forms running around. But then one day, one of the prisoners decides arbitrarily to turn around and to walk out of the cave. And the first thing the prisoner experiences is enlightenment, not in a good way. He's blinded and is confused and can't figure out like what's up or down, and everything is topsy-turvy. And then slowly comes out of blindness, thinking the story of Paul. Yeah, like I said, when we say Christianity is Hellenic, it's not hard to find the associations. Comes out of the blindness and starts to see that here are people who live in the real and who don't take projections from behind them, but who take the world sort of as it is in its fullness. So then he goes back in and tries to tell them, and of course he's challenging the very basis of reality, and so, you know, the dark story of one of the retellings of this is that they killed him, you know, for doing so. But this is a story of the cave and the relationship of the cave and this theme that is not a modern French invention, but Enlightenment goes way back. And I would say this is a late version of Enlightenment. We go into these early stories, and the role of light and darkness is all over the place. But this is sort of, you could say, the philosophical standard of Enlightenment really is this idea of the cave and the escape of appearance and going into reality. And you can see how you could give an Aristotelian internalized reading of that, or a Platonic externalized reading of that. But okay, so that's what the cave means. You can go on with your question now, because I told them what the cave is. Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, how could the prisoner get out of the cave? That is the question. If he cannot actually get out of the cave, then he could never ever reunite the truth.
Right. So one of the many questions you can ask about the allegory, it's an allegory. So some people say, oh, if you can ask questions about it, it means it's a bad allegory. Well, if you want to ask questions about the allegory, maybe it's a good allegory, because it forces you, right, to kind of, you know, like, you can go through and, like, fact-check the Iliad and the Odyssey all you want and stuff like that. You could be missing the point in sort of applying method to these things, but you could just be asking good questions and having an interesting conversation. But yeah, no, I think there's a lot of things that come up, so I'm not going to answer, but I'll give you some options, right? One is, like wait a minute. What is that thing that sparks the desire to turn away? Metanoia, the word for conversion, is the 180-degree turn. Think of the prisoner. The prisoner sitting there, stands up, turns around, 180 degrees, goes out. It's a prefigurement of this notion of conversion that, again, we hear in Paul, me and Pete, you know. And so there's something about that spark that, on the Platonic view, it's the soul's recollection, and the soul is drawn to God, right? Is drawn to the forms. It's not the soul's going out there to check things out and bring back info to tell. You know, there's an erotic movement here, that this is a movement of love. So love of wisdom. Love describes, you could say, eros, the motor that moves the soul into wisdom, to love wisdom and then bring wisdom back, right? That's philosophia, right?
In the process. Wouldn't there also have to be some kind of dissatisfaction or recognition of unfulfillment, or he would turn away? If he was being fully fulfilled,
sure.
He would have left.
Yeah, no, I think absolutely, especially in these early stories, like, we were talking about like nostalgia, like this longing for home when you're not at home, so you're seeking it out or something like
but
that.
But when you're not, like, you realize there's something, there's an emptiness. So
yeah. Oh, totally.
That would have been like. Then it
opens your mind. Totally, yeah. So I think the point you're making, which I think is really important, is that this can be a negative stimulus as much as a positive, right? This can be the nothingness of Genesis or the somethingness of the animals, blah, 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 you know. And I think there's something actually more powerful. Like, I agree. I think there's something more powerful about the negative stimulation, right? The dissatisfaction, right? The what later Rousseau and Marx would call alienation, right? The feeling that this isn't who I am, you know. Yeah.
He's just wondering, was there ever an indication that Plato or Socrates ever believed in the supernatural?
Sure.
There's that, you know, outside of the natural.
Well, that's one of the controversies, right? And so, some of my friends who probably listen to this are going to take me to task for giving airtime to the secular reading of Plato, but I have too many people who I think are way too smart who read Plato as actually giving a non-ideological option to people. But then there are also people who just see Plato as a completely theistic thinker who was drinking right out of the wells of Homer and had this very vast religious sense and saw philosophy and all these things as kind of coming out of it. It really gets into particularities, though, of like Greek, you know, culture and tradition. Because some people are also critical, saying, well, the Greek mythology isn't made for that kind of big wonder and stuff, you know. I don't see, I don't know, and I think we can reserve our judgment and just kind of hold them all in fair portion and just kind of think about it. I do know this, and this will probably be the I'll bring things kind of to a close with this. It'll be a bit of a historical transgression. Whenever we go to the book of Acts of the Apostles, into the section where we have all of Paul's missions. So a lot of people think that Paul's missions are all in his in his letters, but actually there's this whole part of Acts at the very end where he talks about all this stuff, and it's where he gets in prison, he goes to Lycaonia, Asia Minor, he argues with Jews, but then you have Paul's speech before the Council of Areopagus. This is in Athens, right? He says, "Men of Athens, I have seen for myself how extremely scrupulous you are in all religious matters. Because as I strolled round looking at your sacred monuments, monuments to the Greek gods, I noticed, among other things, an altar inscribed to an unknown god. Unknown god. In fact, the unknown god you revere is the one I proclaim to you. Think about Paul going to Athens, knowing at least this portion and more of who he's talking to in context, right? He goes on to say, since the God who made the world and everything in it is himself Lord of heaven and earth, he does not make his home in shrines made by human hands. Nor is he in need of anything that he should be served by human hands. On the contrary, it is he who gives everything, including life and breath, to everyone. From one single principle, he not only created the whole human race so that they could occupy the entire earth, but he decreed the times and limits of their habituation, of their habitation. And he did so that they might seek the deity, lowercase d, and by feeling their way towards him, succeed in finding him. And indeed, he is not far away from any of us. Since it is in him we live, we move, and exist, as indeed some of your own writers have said. We are all his children.
What is it?
Acts, I'm Catholic, so I don't know what chapter and verse I'm on, right? Acts 17, verse 22 to 28.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we go home and get
Go home and read Paul's speech. Because Paul's speech is a fascinating, direct case for why, on the first day of a study of the Catholic intellectual tradition, we would obsess over the Greeks, of whom none of them was a baptized Catholic or Christian or
Jew. Well, didn't have much of a chance,
didn't it? Exactly. It's just impossible, right? So here we see, I think, the most clear vindication that we haven't wasted our time today, the fact that Paul, when he speaks to the Greeks, he speaks to them as a Greek. If you roll over to Romans, he sounds like a Stoic. What was the cool idea in town at the time for the Romans? Stoicism.
All things to all people.
That's Paul, right?
Yeah.
So Paul's method, you can say, is don't be a Catholic, be whoever it is you're speaking to, which requires not just a superficial, oh, I'm going to pretend that we're buddies and stuff, but it means you have to have studied and learned and known and read and cite and allude in very direct ways to the people you're talking about. So the first principle of the Catholic intellectual tradition is that it's not particularly important to be Catholic. In fact, it might be more important to be otherwise as a Catholic. Right?
Isn't that Catholic is universal?
Yeah.
It's not contradictory.
Isn't a contradiction.
Not at all. Being Catholic would mean to be accommodate yourself to the place you're in.
That's right. Yeah. Exactly. So to make a Catholic culture isn't to force everyone in this Athenian compulsory way to your views and beliefs. Sadly, our church has not always, and still today doesn't always understand this. But to be Catholic in this Pauline Hellenic epic sense is, in fact, to take the Achilles challenge and to die in order to live. In other words, enough about me. How about you? Right? What is your culture? What do you like to eat? What are your songs about? What are your stories? Right?
What if the culture is repugnant? Some of their practices are repugnant to you. Say, Paul had encountered a culture that's just sacrificing children to their gods or something like that.
There's nothing in Greek society that Paul. In other words, there's. So this is really important. It's really important to note that this doesn't mean to say that all cultures are great, or that the Greeks were like this especially great culture. No, no, no.
There were slave-owning cultures.
There were slave owners. Yeah. There was, you know, the Spartans had a ritual of infanticide that went along with this in terms of selection. There was nothing that Paul, if Paul wanted to, he could have excoriated them for all of the evil things they were doing. He could have come in and said, like, this is stupid. This makes no sense. You killed Socrates. What were you thinking? You know, you're all going to hell, you know. But he didn't take that approach. Yeah. He didn't take that approach. When we look at stories like the Book of Rules, stories like the Iliad, if you read the Old Testament, there's plenty to be objectionable to on moral grounds. But I think that this means that without giving a sort of relativistic pass to things, that you focus your emphasis on the highest order of things. He's talking in this little passage about the deity that's outside and inside that the writers have cited to. He's talking about metaphysics, about poesis, about their own altar to their own unknown God. I mean, he's basically choosing to find that common thread that in your first question you pulled out, this idea that all humans share these deep senses of interest and big questions, big themes, stuff like that.
He kind of changes his external, he changes his mannerisms and his language, but his substance doesn't change.
Right. No, this is important. Very Aristotelian of you, right? Yeah. So the accidental properties of his recitation, maybe the words he uses, But the substance of his message doesn't get changed. And so this is another thing to point out, thank you, is that the Catholic intellectual tradition has to be big enough to be able to go under accidental change without substantial change. So when people say, like, the church never changes, I say, well, it just depends. If you mean the accidental church, we change a lot in history, at St. Mark's you'll see that some people stand and some people kneel. And some people say, like, oh, the people who stand, they're not doing what kneel. Well, if you read the early church, everyone stood in the 5th century, right? So you can go on if you want, but then you can say, well, the common ritual now says we should kneel. Well, the fact is, we've never stood or kneeled all at the same time universally as a church. Our liturgy has never been codified that way. It also means you should probably have a sense of intentionality of why you're standing or why you're kneeling, or what prevents you from kneeling or from standing, or why you're sitting, or whatever you want to do, prostrate, whatever. The point, though, is that those changes are accidental changes. The substance of the fact that there is a time to be reverent before the presence of God, that's never changed, right? So, but again, I'm even using Aristotelian, not Catholic, Greek ideas, substance and accident, as a way to give an explanatory hypothesis for how this can work, right? So I guess on the first day, the biggest thing I want to kind of drill, if that's reasonable to say something like that, is that the Catholic intellectual tradition should not be a navel-gazing Catholicism that is defensive, that is trying to establish its clear borders, its clear lines, make sure we know who our people are and who the that hopefully you see by evidence that the entire first day of lectures on the Catholic intellectual tradition, we've talked about only one Catholic.
Back with more Catholic intellectual tradition on Breadbox Media.
You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
Are we on? Hey, it's Rosalie Contrite of ContriteCatholic.com and This Catholic Life podcast, where we talk about everything from NFP to striving for holiness in today's world. If you're looking for polished, don't check me out. But if you want honest and unedited, listen to This Catholic Life, my home when I'm not standing in line for confession. You can find me on iTunes, Stitcher, and at BreadboxMedia.com.
This is Sam Rocha, and you are listening to a Breadbox Media presentation of my lectures on the Catholic intellectual tradition, given at St. Mark's College in Vancouver, British Columbia.
That hopefully you see my evidence that the entire first day of lectures on the Catholic intellectual tradition, we've talked about only one Catholic. Should hopefully, yet hopefully in a justifying way in relation to everyone else, that you don't have to be afraid of non-Catholic ideas and stuff and books and stuff. Read whatever you want. Study whatever you can. Know as much as you can. There's nothing particularly from a Catholic worldview. Identity shouldn't be what drives our interests, right? Now, maybe it will because we're feeling very Odyssean. We want to go home, right? Like for me, my substitute for home in terms of Brady, Texas, has really become the church. Right? It's become, now, that's dangerous in a lot of ways, right? Mm-hmm. But what else? I don't know where I would be buried, but I know what kind of funeral I want. So these are very real things for me, right? This is still autobiographical, as I said at the beginning. But that's for me sort of the lesson that we might take from this first kind of very Athens Greek heavy day. Any questions? We have about 10 minutes.
Yeah. You know where the Greeks know God? Where did that come from? Like, was that in around 800 years before that, or is that?
I don't actually. I should use that passage in the way I did. I should know some more about that altar, but I have no idea.
Because we think of Greek gods. We think of, you know, they're a lot of times they're capricious, they're silly, they're heavy-handed, you know.
Yeah. And I would say so. I can't disagree with that reading because when I read them, that's what I think. But let's also remember that this is the post-method reading of the gods. There were people, Monica, Augustine's mother, who I'll talk about next, who treated them, with deep reverence and deep affection. I mean, I walk into my favorite Vietnamese restaurant, and there's an altar to Buddha, and I don't believe in that in particular, but I can recognize the religious form of expression, and I wouldn't vandalize it. Right? I see it as a part of the sacred imagination, right? And so, to me, it's good.
So I mean, they have a Buddha and a crucifix in the same store too.
That's just in case. That's very Mexican to me, right? Because there's a whole kind of, you know, you go to like the shrine of Our Lady of Guadalupe and Mexico City, and what was that?
What happened?
Oh, it's a completely mixed expression. In fact, I think First Thing sent a correspondent for like a big feast down there, and they showed up, and there was like Aztec dancing and feathers and rituals, and they were like, this isn't Catholicism, this is very bad, right? You know, and it was just a very North, you know, they just didn't get it, right? But so to me, even sometimes the question of how to mix cultures, liturgical expression, things like that, I mean, it becomes even more salient. But I would say that that's not really, we're moving into an insider baseball question, a sort of questions of cultural appropriation and stuff like that. The bigger theme is that, to go to the very beginning, even the beginning as the beginning, right? The whole question of the beginning. I think you have to at least feel something in your gut that has a sense that despite the modes of expression and languages, that there is this universal thing that we can throw lots of words and lots of stories and lots of ideas against, but that ultimately that thing is immune to our abuse, right? That is, it can withstand all of that. So one of the things I say is that for many of the people who defend Catholicism with such gusto, but they defend Catholicism all the time, it's like, you know, my view is that if my things that are so big that nothing can change them usually don't get defended. We don't find people, when people defend ecology, they usually defend very like fragile ecological sites, you know, and now we could get into like what constitutes a fragile ecological site, you know, coral reefs, et cetera, whatever. But no one defends, I mean, you know, erosion and stuff like that, but there are certain mountains out there that you're like, yeah, you're okay, you're gonna. I mean, not really, given what the human capacity for ecological destruction is, but. Like, yeah, the oceans will rise and change, coral reefs will change, but, like, the very being of the ocean is something that I don't think anyone's like, oh, man, or, like, the desert, no one's like, oh, man, you know, I mean, it might degrade in certain ways, become more hospitable or inhospitable, it might turn on us or whatever, but there's a sense of, like, when something needs to be defended so much, maybe the question we should ask is, why is our belief in something... Why is this something so small that it needs so much very petty, constant defenses? Why aren't we like Paul telling people, that big thing you have is my big thing. Let me tell you about that big thing, this unknown God thing, and talk about it in language that we can share maybe, I don't know if they bought Paul's apologia, you know. But like the Greek Orthodox Church, that's it. They bought it. the entire rise of Eastern Orthodoxy from the Greek Church. I mean, the New Testament, by the way, is obviously written in a language that is neither Aramaic nor Latin. It's Greek, right? Another evidence for the importance of Hellenism, right? So I guess just the theme to end all of these themes and relations of this opening genealogy is a kind of a quiet confidence. That we don't have to worry as to think of the Catholic intellectual tradition as this fragile thing that everyone's forgetting and no one knows God and it's going to go away. And it's fine. Even if we forget about it, it'll still be fine, right? Yeah.
I don't really think people do know what the Church teaches, though. From, like, we're talking the secular world.
Sure.
There's a great degree of ignorance. That's not to say, like, I personally have to go out and, and talk to those class ends. But I mean, like, you know, I think of First Peter, you have to make a defense for, you know. And I think it's incredible sometimes. People have an extremely negative view of the faith, of the Church, all these things. And what they base it on is, like, totally unfactual, totally untrue.
Sure. Yeah. But you know what my usual approach is, and we'll hear about this tomorrow, is to say, you think that's bad? Let me tell you worse things. You don't even know the worst things. Like, the problem isn't that people know only bad stuff. It's that the bad stuff they know is, like, very easy. Like, of course, pedophile priests, like, you want to hear something way worse than that? Like, you know,
anti-Semitism.
Talk about genocide, right? You know, like, to me, it's not just, like, a good narrative versus bad narrative. It's just a certain shallowness, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I believe that in terms of testimony, that maybe we live in an age where a Pauline approach is more needed in a vastly cosmopolitan... I mean, it's wonderful that not everyone is Catholic in this room. Honestly, I'm really happy about that, right? It's more faithful to what I'm trying to argue that the Catholic intellectual tradition is, right? And it doesn't make me feel like I'm any less Catholic, and hopefully you don't feel that way. And hopefully you don't feel like I'm trying to drag you to church, you know, right? So... this is possible. And I think Paul models it in a way. Now, obviously, at the Council of Jerusalem, Paul and Peter don't quite see eye on this. And Peter's... But let me just say, Peter's right about a lot of stuff, and I shouldn't be too cavalier about our first pope. But at the Council of Jerusalem, there was one view of Catholicism that came out ahead of the other, and it was definitely Paul's. Because Paul said... You mean, you want to get grown men to get circumcised? Like, really? Like, oh yeah, this is the law, this is what we have to do. You know, we can't give up one thing for the other. People don't have to know what we teach and what our laws are. And Paul's like, dude, that's not the big stuff. The big stuff is this. And so to me, not only do I want to say that, like, Paul is good for our times, but Paul was really good for these times, too.
Yeah.
So, you know, so I'm going to take in this model a much more Pauline approach, but I think it's also useful that Peter be at the table. And this is where I think we can become very ungenerous also, where we want to kick out all of the authoritarians. I think we need some Spartans around, you know. You know, it's not I think we can be generous even to faults in some cases. But anyway, so that's all we have for today. Hope you'll come back tomorrow.
Can I just ask one last question?
Yeah, of course.
Just because of the kind of situation in the world today, you know how we were talking about how we have to be big enough and we're not navel gazing. We can't be just immersed in ourselves and our own limitedness. How can we tell people, like, how we cannot afford to be afraid of the other? You know, the other religions, the other views, the other ideologies, how we reach out to them. For the very limited Catholics who are so filled, or any other people, that are so filled with this fear of the other.
I mean, I think you just point to the church itself. You don't have to leave the church to see each other. I mean, the range of cultural expression within the church today, just in the global south, is enough to flip around any number of cultural affectations of Anglophone and Western European assumptions about Catholicism. Another great place for Catholics who want to see Catholicism bigger than Catholicism without having to leave Catholicism, look at these. Look at the churches. You know, you go to the Holy Land, guess what? Rome doesn't really own a whole lot of the sacred sites in the Holy Land. They're owned by the Coptic Church. They're owned by the Melkite Rite. They're owned by the...
Yeah.
Because they're the more ancient churches, right? We're a very late church to the Christian scene of churches in this area. Many of them don't speak Greek, Aramaic, or Latin. Many of the earliest ones speak Arabic. So they pray to Allah every Sunday, right? So... There's an adversity within the church that I think a lot of people could begin with if they were a little bit sketchy. And then after that, read the Quran, read the Bhagavad Gita, read whatever, you know, or read a little bit of philosophy, read the newspaper, it doesn't matter.
This is Sam Rocha, and you have been listening to a Breadbox Media presentation of my lectures on the Catholic intellectual tradition given at St. Mark's College in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.